Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Wednesday, June 29th, 2016, starting at 1:28 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 82nd episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm joined by Kelly Surtees and Lisa Scheim, and we're going to be doing our first ever question and answer episode, where different listeners have sent in questions, and we're going to be going through them. So we've got a lot of questions to answer, so let's get right to it. Kelly and Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. And let's see. So before we get started, people can find out more information about each of you on your websites. Kelly, what's your website again?
It's kellysastrology.com. So kellysastrology.com.
Awesome. And Lisa?
Mine's just lisascheim.com.
Okay. And my website, as usual, is chrisbrennanastrologer.com. So before we jump into it, we've got a few news and announcement type things. So the first off, as I mentioned in the last episode, and you can go back and listen to the forecast episode for the full sort of rundown of the latest news and announcements. But one of the things is tomorrow is the deadline for nominating the Astrology Podcast for an ESAR award. So ESAR is giving out this award for best audiovisual production at their upcoming conference in October. And there's an open call for nominations right now. So if you'd like to nominate the Astrology Podcast for an award, then all you have to do is send an email to Glenn Perry at glenn@aaperry.com saying that you'd like to nominate the podcast and give them a link to it. Please CC Sam Reynolds. His email is unlockastrology@gmail.com. And if the podcast gets enough nominations in the next 24 hours, I guess, before the end of June 30th, then it could win an award, which would be kind of cool. So that's our first announcement. Our second announcement is, of course, this is the final episode of June. So we've got to do our June giveaway drawing where we've got two prizes this month for patrons on the $5 and $10 tiers from what are essentially our sponsors this month, which are the ESAR Astrology Conference, which is taking place in October, and the Mountain Astrologer magazine, which publishes a regular astrological magazine 6 times a year. So we're giving away one free pass to the ESAR conference in October, and we're giving away one free 1-year subscription to the Mountain Astrologer magazine. So yeah, so those are both great things. I've been really excited about this whole process, and it's been working out really well. And Kelly, I think you just said it turns out you're going to be speaking at the ESAR conference now, right?
That is true. Yes. I know when we spoke earlier this week, I was not, but there has been a turn in my fortune and I will be. So I am not sure 100% what my lecture will be yet, but I'll be talking on Saturday morning, I believe.
Okay. Awesome. And Lisa, you're also speaking at the ESAR conference, right?
Yeah, I'll be speaking on the 12-year cycle of repetitions of annual perfections.
Okay, and I will be giving a talk on how to time peak periods in a person's career and eminence, which is supposed to be tied in especially with the presidential election. And we'll look at a few presidential charts and perhaps talk about the upcoming presidential election, which will take place just a few weeks later. So, yeah, so the ESAR conference, it's being hosted by the International Society for Astrological Research. It's going to be the biggest conference event of the year. I think everybody's really looking forward to it. It's being held in Costa Mesa, California from October 13th through the 17th of 2016. The focus of the conference is on astrological forecasting, and the tagline is, "The power of forecasting meets the consequence of choice." So I guess that gives you some like parameters for like what talks you would have to give, right, Kelly, in terms of you focus on a forecasting talk?
Totally. I suspect I will end up doing something on progressions, which is one of my favorite forecasting or predictive tools. But we're just waiting to finalize that. But yeah, the whole conference topic around the forecasting, it's such a practical and useful part of astrology.
Yeah, I really like that as a theme, because then you really have all of the astrologers coming and giving their best talks on the different forecasting techniques or different things surrounding the philosophy of astrological forecasting and things like that.
Totally. So, if people can't make it in the flesh, I think the recordings are going to be amazing.
Definitely. So the conference is going to feature more than 60 speakers from around the world. There's going to be 6 different tracks on different topics, plus numerous pre-conference and post-conference workshops, and also 2 separate panels on the U.S. presidential election, which will be predicting the outcome of who's going to become the next president of the United States. So for more information about the conference, you can go to their website at esarastrology.org. So let me reach into my high-tech bowl of names and see who the winner of the giveaway is.
I'm surprised you haven't come up with some kind of app for this, Chris.
I know. I actually need to. I guess that would be more high-tech of me.
Well, it would be. I guess you're allowed to be out of character occasionally.
Actually, initially pulled it from the wrong bowl. All right, let's see. The name is Scotty Hudson. So Scotty Hudson is the winner of the $10 tier this month, and he gets a free pass to the upcoming ESAR conference in October. That's actually really awesome. He's been a long time patron on the $10 tier and a big supporter of the show. So I'm glad to see his name.
That's fantastic. That's a prize that has quite a few hundred dollars value too.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, tickets to the ESAR conference are $300 or $400. So that's really the goal here is, I wanted to figure out some sort of system, and all of this is an experiment still, but figure out a system to, be able to promote stuff that's going on in the community that's important and that I'm interested in, but also, give something back to the listeners. And it seemed like a good way to do that. All right. Well, Scotty, if you're listening to this, just send me an email and I will give you instructions on how to collect your prize. And hopefully we'll all see you at the conference on October and we'll have to hang out and get a drink or something. All right. So that is our first drawing for the month. Our second drawing for the month is a free 1-year subscription to the Mountain Astrologer magazine for a patron on our $5 tier. The Mountain Astrologer magazine, or TMA for short, is published 6 times a year for nearly 30 years now. So they're going through their first Saturn return with Saturn in Sagittarius when the magazine was first started in the 1980s. So it's just about slightly younger than I am, which is pretty impressive. It's become the main publication for students of astrology and professionals of astrology because it helps to keep you connected with what's going on in the astrological community. It covers just about everything. They've got well-edited feature articles. They've got a student section. They've got detailed forecasts and astro humor and cartoons. So you can find out more information about TMA, and they also have an online blog with a bunch of great free articles on their website, plus 15 years of back issues that they've digitalized, available online at their website at mountainastrologer.com. So let's see, pulling a name to see who the winner is this month. Who's this? Okay, Freeman Presson. So the winner of the 1-year subscription to the Mountain Astrologer magazine this month is Freeman Presson.
Congratulations, Freeman.
Hey, congratulations.
Awesome. Well, that's really exciting. Freeman's also been a longtime supporter. And yeah, so you'll get, just send me an email and I'll give you the, tell you the instructions for how to collect your prize. And congratulations. Now you can read the electional section that Lisa and I do every month in the Mountain Astrologer magazine. And of course, Kelly's regular articles every once in a while. As recently as 2 or 3 months ago, right, Kelly?
Yeah, just earlier this year, I had a piece on the 3rd and 6th houses traditionally.
Excellent. All right. Well, congratulations to both of our winners this month. And thanks, everyone, for supporting the podcast and being patrons. I'm in the process of lining up the prizes for next month, but I think it's actually going to be, we're going to do a software giveaway next month where the top tier prize I think I've worked out is going to be a free copy of the astrology program called Solar Fire, which is one of the main programs that lots of people use. I know it's the program that Lisa and I use. I think it goes for something $400 plus at this point. So it'll be a great giveaway next month. So if you want to be in the giveaway next month, then just become a patron on the $5 or $10 tier and you'll be all set. And thanks also to ESAR and to the Mountain Astrologer magazine for being our sponsors this month for this month's giveaway. All right, so let's get on to the main topic of the show, which is the questions that have been sent in over the course of the past couple of months since I announced this, I think, at the end of April. So we've been building up to this for a while, and we ended up getting a lot of questions. So I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get through all of them today. but we're going to do our best to make a large dent in them. And perhaps if there's some that are left over, we might be able to carry over a few of them into the next Q&A episode in the future. So our first question actually comes from Twitter a few weeks ago, and it comes from a Twitter user named Gaston Garcia, who said, what's a good way to learn astrology step-by-step for beginners? So for this, actually, Kelly and I did an episode of the Astrology Podcast last year. Episode 31 was me and Kelly doing an episode titled Tips for Learning Astrology and Becoming an Astrologer. And that would be a great resource for how to learn astrology that I'd really recommend checking out, because we really packed a lot into that episode. Otherwise, I mean, my advice would be to use www.astro.com for charts in order to generate charts. Get a copy of an ephemeris, preferably like a printed copy, although you can also get free copies online through AstroDienst, through astro.com. And just start looking at charts and transits for everybody you know on a regular basis. And I think that's a really great way to really get into the basics of astrology and get a fundamental sort of grounding in just the techniques of how it works and what you're working with, just by looking at your own chart and transits and looking at other people's charts and transits. So that would be my starting point. What would you guys say?
Well, one of my favorite beginner books, if you're asking about actual like basics, you know, understanding the definitions of what different signs are like and so forth, April Elliott Kent's book, The Essential Guide to Practical Astrology, was out of print, but it's actually just recently become available again in the Kindle version, and then it's supposed to be back in paperback soon. So that's actually a really good resource that I've found for people who need to go right from the beginning. I agree with doing charts for friends and family, and in particular, I think if you're just starting out, it can be really useful to watch the sun transits. It's pretty basic, but then you get a sense of, you know, the sun transits about a degree a day. So when they go over placements in your chart or friends or family's charts, you can watch and see exactly what happens at those times. So I think that's a really good starting point as well. And then, of course, the Mountain Astrologer is a great resource. And yeah, there's a lot of other things to go from there.
Yeah, I think what you guys have said is fantastic. And the only thing that I would add in is just to go slowly. If you are an absolute beginner, don't try and run before you can walk. Just take your time to take it all in. And the other thing that I found really helpful when I was studying was to take some classes. So to find an astrologer that you connect with either in person or online and sign up, you know, whether it's just a 6-week class or you sign up for a 12-month program. The first class you take in astrology will not be the last one, but it may really help you get a good grounding in the basics or the foundations. And then you've got a platform that you can continue building on for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. And that was something that I didn't realize until I actually had teachers, is some of the benefits of that in terms of, I did self-study for the first 4 or 5 years. And with self-study, you know, there's pros and cons to either way you go. But one of the downsides is that if you have like a teacher or somebody that's been doing it for a while to sort of guide you, it can really accelerate your studies in terms of going straight to the best sources and having somebody that can tell you like what you need to focus on at different points in your studies, rather than just kind of, you know, reaching around and trying to find your way sort of in the dark and not knowing what resources are out there or what things you should be focusing on. And instead, you know, sort of having to learn that the hard way. Sometimes having a teacher can be a really nice step in terms of just, you know, taking a shortcut towards finding out some of the best resources that you might not know otherwise. So, of course, the downside to having a teacher that sometimes comes up is sometimes that can lead you towards a specific approach and adopting the teacher's approach without necessarily, you know, it's not a given that whatever teacher you've happened to run into or you know, started learning under will necessarily have the best approach or like the only approach to astrology. And so sometimes one of the downsides can be getting too locked into a specific approach rather than studying many different approaches. But it's still probably the benefits probably outweigh the potential downsides, as long as you're careful about that.
Yeah, for sure. And I often say to students that think about the first person you study with, you know, with astrology as perhaps your kindergarten or your year one teacher who taught you your basic letters and maybe some basic words. And you had other teachers and your skills developed. So your first teacher ideally shouldn't be your only teacher, because I totally agree with you, Chris. There's such value in getting out there and connecting with different teachers or learning about the different types and different applications of astrology. There's certainly, you know, not just one way.
Right. Definitely. Okay. So I think that answers things pretty quick. So definitely check out that article or that previous podcast, episode 31 that I mentioned, and you'll find a ton of other additional tips for getting started in learning astrology. All right. So thanks for that question, Gaston Garcia. All right. So moving on to the second question. This one comes from Christina Unzicker. And she says, in your experience, how accurate is software like AstroDeans at calculating degrees, since when using whole sign houses, the difference between 29 degrees of one sign and 0 degrees of the next sign can be pretty huge? She goes on to say, for example, in my own chart, the ruler of the ascendant is Jupiter, which is retrograde at 0 degrees and 18 minutes of Leo in the ninth whole sign house. If that's off by just a smidgen, then it's really in Cancer in my eighth house, and I assume that could mean a fairly different life path for me. Have you ever run into a situation where you question the accuracy of that small of a scale, or do you find it to hold true? Okay, so I would say for that my first, to answer the first part of that question, AstroDienst is definitely the most accurate chart calculation site that we have, or that is out there in the astrological community. They're one of the oldest software companies in the astrological community, and they actually produce the ephemeris that most other programs use. It's called the Swiss ephemeris. And so I think SolarFire and Sirius and many of the other, you know, actual software programs, they all draw on the same ephemeris or the same ephemeris program. It's like a coded ephemeris that started being produced by AstroDienst in the mid-1990s. And that ephemeris is based on a set of ephemerides that are used by NASA and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So in terms of accuracy, that's, you know, the best you're going to find. And AstroDienst is generally pretty reliable in that regard. In terms of, you know, planets that are really close to sign cusps, when it comes to outer planets like that, I don't think you have to worry as much, because Jupiter, for example, in the instance that you mentioned in your chart, it actually wouldn't retrograde back into Cancer for several more days after you were born. So in instances like that, where you're talking about planets that won't change signs, you know, for days, compared to like, you know, a day or an hour or even like a few minutes, which is sometimes the case with faster moving planets like the moon or something like that, you do run into a bit of an issue at that point. But when it comes to outer planets where it's like several days from retrograding, you know, I think Jupiter would firmly be in Leo in that instance in your chart. Have you guys come across this, or what do you guys think?
I have noticed, I think, one occasion where astro.com was a little bit off from SolarFire, but it was more to do with the geography maps section rather than the planet info. So I think you could certainly rely on what's coming at you from astro.com. And that was going to be my point completely, Chris. A slower moving planet like Jupiter, if you're really concerned, grab the ephemeris, which I just did. Christina is actually born very close to when I'm born. And so I'm very familiar with this zero Leo retro Jupiter. But it was 4 or 5 days after she was born that it changed signs. So you very definitely have your ascendant ruler in the ninth house.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, one of the things that's interesting in terms of the astrology software programs that surprised me when I first got into astrology, and I'm not sure if most people realize, is that, you know, the programs are not taking real-time measurements of where the planets are, like in the sky at that moment. That's not actually how the programs work. And I guess I should explain what I mean by that. It's like they're not using, like, SolarFire or AstroDienst is not like connected up to like an observatory, which is then moment by moment tracking where the planets are, but instead these are all computed positions where it's like at some point in the past, they've taken very specific measurements of where the planets were then and what their trajectory was and where they have been in the past. And then they, in the ephemeris, they will then project that out in terms of where those planets will be in the future based on what we know about their movements and their, you know, speed and how frequently they go retrograde and things like that. But that's actually one of the interesting things about, you know, to almost like go back on or counter my statement from earlier. It's always been kind of interesting to me that the astrology programs and stuff are based on ephemerides, which are produced, you know, years ago in the past. And therefore, most of the positions are based on predicted positions of where the planets will be in the future or sometimes where they were in the past. So, but the thing about that is that the outer planet, the planetary cycles are known with such precision, and we have the math down so well that if you're talking about planetary positions within a century or two, there's usually very little deviation from the predicted sort of paths of where the math basically says the planets should be versus the actual observed paths of when they actually end up. It's extremely accurate just because we've got the math and the planetary orbits down so well at this point in time. But nonetheless, it's still worth noting that, you know, the programs are not measuring the positions of the planets sort of live, but instead they're almost based on mathematical models and projections. But nonetheless, they're extremely accurate projections.
So the only thing I'd have to add to that is, astro.com had always seemed pretty accurate to me for natal charts. And mostly I've been using Solarfire for a long time now. Sometimes if anything can be off, it can be a matter of either the place's longitude and latitude being exact or it being in that database for that particular software. Or all of the local time changes being in there incorrect, especially like if you're looking a few years in the future or something like that. So if you have any doubts at all, I mean, and mostly they're good, but if you have any doubts, it would be good to double check like the longitude and latitude that's listed for those places and the time zone or daylight savings time status at that time. Because I think that's the only thing that it could change. It wouldn't change a planet like your Jupiter, but it could change like a rising sign, especially if it was close, you know, early or late in the degree, things like that.
Yeah. And that's really the biggest area of sort of chaos in terms of astrological programs is that the sort of timing of when certain cities or certain states or areas or countries had daylight savings versus didn't have daylight savings, because that can change from year to year as different countries adopt different standards or different states have their own local standards, or sometimes certain cities have their own local standards and change them from time to time. That's been something that's given the astrological community major headaches over the course of the past decade. And there's been entire, there's entire books, the American Atlas or the International Atlas is largely dedicated to documenting time zone changes so that you know whether daylight savings time was in effect in different areas at different times. And there's certain cities where it's just a mess and it's very uncertain whether it was daylight savings time or not daylight savings time, which basically throws things off by an hour. So, but like Lisa said, that's more of an issue if you're trying to determine the correct ascendant or if the ascendant is close to a sign cusp or if there's some ambiguity if you're born in an area where it's not clear if daylight savings time was in effect or not. But for the most part, if you're talking about ephemeris positions, those calculations are going to be extremely accurate. So let's see, there was a second question that Christina had where she said, on a slightly related note, do you ever consider out of sign aspects? So, in Hellenistic astrology, they primarily did sign-based aspects. They did have some degree-based aspects, but only if they were pretty close, like within a few degrees, if we're talking about most of the planets, or if it was within 13 degrees, if it was talking about the moon. And definitely with that 13 degree rule with the moon, that's something that I've really seen hold true. If the moon is applying to another planet within 13 degrees, even if it's out of sign, that next aspect still is really clearly relevant in terms of what that ends up indicating in the person's life. And I know I've used in some of my lectures, like my Rulers of the Houses lecture, I use the examples of Robert Kennedy and Princess Diana, who both had the moon applying to either an out-of-sign square or an out-of-sign opposition with Mars in a day chart. And that ended up being really, really sort of prescient in terms of some of the things that ended up happening in their life in those specific areas that the moon ruled in their chart. So that would be my answer is yes, if it's relatively close, or in the case of the moon, yes, if it's within 13 degrees. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I would say the same. If it's really close, then I would think about how that was impacting the other planet that it was close to, or if it was close to an angle in particular. But I would still consider each of them in their separate whole sign houses as well, in terms of delineation of like planet in house.
Sure. How do you treat out of sign aspects, Kelly?
Oh, yeah. It's very similar to you guys. And I think the only thing I would add is that I would consider that an out of sign trine, for instance, may not be as potent as an in sign trine. So in some of the conditions that you guys have mentioned, you know, if it's within the degree, particularly with the moon, maybe it's a conjunction that's very close, but the planets are in two different signs. But understanding the origins of aspect theory, where so much was based on the sign-sign connection of two planets, I would just maybe slightly take it down a notch in terms of how significant I might think that particular aspect is, all other things being equal.
Yeah, definitely. And that really brings up a point that has been coming back to me over the past couple of months as I've been really focused on my book and trying to write this, you know, broad overview of Hellenistic astrology and of the earliest tradition of, you know, Western astrology that used the fourfold system of planets, signs, houses, and aspects, is that in almost every area, the signs of the zodiac acted as like the backbone for the entire system and acted as a backdrop, both for the aspect doctrine, but also for the houses. So this becomes relevant in terms of the debate about whole sign houses, in terms of realizing that, you know, why they were using the signs as the backdrop for the 12 houses. But one of the arguments actually for whole sign houses and its prevalence in the early tradition is seeing that it wasn't just restricted to the houses, but they were doing that for aspects and for other things as well. So that the aspect doctrine, it was partially predicated on the ability of the planets to have an affinity or a lack of affinity with each other based on the signs that they were placed in, under the premise that each of the signs has a few fundamental qualities like gender, element, and modality or quadruplicity, cardinal, fixed, and mutable. And that if planets are in signs that have matching qualities, then that means they're going to be in aspect with each other and therefore share a relationship. Whereas if planets are in signs that don't match in those qualities, then they're not going to be able to share a relationship because they don't have anything in common. So that goes back to what Kelly's saying in terms of there's a big difference. Like even if, let's say, planets are, you know, aspecting each other by degree within like a degree or two, even though they're across sign boundaries, there's still going to be a much different flavor to that type of configuration if they're in signs that are, you know, not aspecting each other, or if they're in signs that share a different type of relationship than the aspect that you're looking at. So for example, like trines, part of the reason trines were originally conceptualized as good, and part of the conceptual motivation is that planets that are in signs that are trines share the same gender and the same triplicity or the same element. Whereas signs that are square share only the same modality, cardinal, fixed, or mutable, but otherwise they're different elements and different genders. Actually, that's not correct. So Aries, yeah, no, Aries.
Yeah,
Aries,
yeah, they're different. Yeah, one is cold and one is hot.
Sure.
They have more at odds with each other.
Right.
And yeah, you totally agree, Chris.
I thought I reversed it for a second, but no, that's correct. So the point there, so that would really feed in just conceptually would you know, explain part of what you're talking about, Kelly, just in terms of there's a difference between you know, let's say, you know, a square or a trine by degree, you know, across sign boundaries versus one that's in the appropriate signs, or a square or a trine by sign, right?
For sure. I mean, an example might be somebody who has Jupiter towards the end of Cancer, which would make a trine to a planet towards the end of Scorpio, or, you know, a sign-based trine to any planet in Scorpio. And we've got the water triplicity or elemental connection there. And then somebody might say, well, I've got the moon in early Sag, and by degree that makes a trine to Jupiter in Cancer. And that's maybe not a great example because there's a little bit of rulership there, but we'll just ignore that for the moment. But a planet in a fire sign does not have the same kind of, I don't know, warmth or appreciation or understanding of how a planet in a water sign operates. So it's kind of hard to see how it could be as juicy and flowing as a trine that operates according to those sign-based principles.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's really crucial. And it's just important for understanding the original sort of approach to Western astrology. And this is something that I'm really going to try to draw out in my book, is just how the signs of the zodiac really acted as a backdrop for everything with respect to the planets and their relationships with each other and their placement in the chart in a way that's much more prominent than in modern astrology. Because, you know, starting around the time of the Renaissance with guys like Kepler, Kepler, you know, he didn't like the zodiac conceptually. And so he had a tendency to either reject or to downplay the zodiac and instead to focus on the aspect doctrine, and specifically to focus on aspects as just, you know, harmonics between planets or degree-based geometrical relationships between planets. And that was always part of what the aspects were, but they were originally viewed as partially as these geometrical relationships between signs and the ability of planets to relate to each other through the signs that they were in, which secondarily had this sort of secondary geometrical component. So what happens in the Renaissance is you have guys like Kepler that are emphasizing more of the geometrical component with aspects and sort of downplaying the zodiac. And then at the same time, you have other guys like William Lilly and some of the other Renaissance astrologers that are really focused on horary astrology, which is much more directed towards kind of dynamic relationships between planets and applying and separating aspects and questions about whether, you know, relevant significators in a chart will complete aspects with each other or whether they won't. And so you have this sort of shift in focus towards much more of a degree-based focus in that time. And I feel like that just accelerated in modern astrology in the 20th century, where it was kind of interesting, where even though you have books like in 1968, Linda Goodman's book, Sun Signs, that really focus on and popularize the concept of the zodiac and of the sun sign as being like this core thing in astrology, especially in this sort of popular consciousness, in the actual astrological circles, there's a tendency to focus primarily on like degrees between planets and aspects as geometrical configurations. So one of the things I'm trying to do in my work is bring back this orientation towards integrating the zodiac as this key component underlying not just aspect doctrine, but also the houses, transits, synastry, and other things as well. So that's part of my answer to that question. All right. So that's question number two. I think we might be going not at a very brisk pace, yeah. But I think maybe we'll pick it up a little bit. Okay. So yeah. And then of course we get to question three, which is one of our longer questions.
Longest question we have.
Sure. So I don't know if we'll be able to take all of them because it's actually several separate questions and sub questions, but some of them are very good. So I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about this one. So the first question, this is from Marlene Stalker. The first question she has is, she says, were Arabic parts used in Hellenistic astrology? And if so, how? So this is, the timing on this is actually really excellent because I literally just finished writing my chapter on the quote-unquote Arabic parts in my book on Hellenistic astrology yesterday. I just sort of finalized it while I was sitting at a coffee shop trying to finalize it over the course of the past week yesterday. So good timing. So the answer to this question is that, yes, Arabic parts were used in Hellenistic astrology. And in fact, the concept or the technique actually originated there. And as a result of that, some people like myself argue that the term Arabic part is a misnomer, because the Arabic astrological tradition only started sometime around the year 775 CE. But this technique had actually been in use since about the first century BC. So for about 700 or 800 years, this technique was already being used before the astrologers who wrote in Arabic started using it. And they actually inherited it from the earlier Hellenistic tradition of astrologers that were writing in Greek and Latin and other languages. So in the Hellenistic tradition, they actually originally called the concept lots, which is kind of related to the modern concept of a lottery, where everybody, like we just did earlier in the show, where, you know, you write a bunch of names on little pieces of paper or little scraps of paper, and then sort of shake it up and then pull one of the names randomly, and, you know, somebody wins a prize. That was actually the concept underlying this technique originally, and they were specifically called lots for that reason, in order to invoke this idea of sort of a random or chance sort of shaking up of something, shaking up of significators in the chart that then sort of spits out a specific outcome. And originally, this was tied in with a lot of other things in the ancient world, and this ancient type of divination called cleromancy, which is where people would cast lots or they would draw lots in order to determine the outcome for something. But they were doing so under the premise that there was some sort of divine agency that would make sure that the correct outcome or the best outcome would occur, even though the process otherwise seemed very random or very chance-like, that somehow fortune or chance was somehow subservient to fate, so that the outcome itself would be fated in some sense, but in more of like a providential or positive sense. Anyways, so lots were used in the Hellenistic tradition, and the way that they were used is in a few different ways, but the primary way that they were used is in order to assign additional topics to the signs or to the houses. So they had this whole collection of different lots that would signify different things, like the primary set of lots were for different family members. So, for example, the fourth house in the Hellenistic tradition was generally said to signify the parents, but they didn't really seem to have any differentiation between, you know, in modern astrology, we have sometimes astrologers who say that the fourth house signifies the mother or the father, and the 10th house signifies the other parent. They don't seem to have had that distinction, as far as I can tell, in Hellenistic astrology, but instead what they did is they, in order to differentiate the mother or the father, they would use a specific lot. So they had a lot called the lot of the father, and they had another lot that was called the lot of the mother. And if you wanted to look at a specific parent in the chart, you would then pull out one of those lots and calculate it. And then whatever sign it falls in the chart, that sign, the entirety of that sign, will take on the topics associated with that lot, which in this instance is the significations of the mother or the father. So essentially what it was is they were doing this within the context of whole sign houses, but then you calculate the lot, and whatever sign it falls in, that sign and its whole sign house will then take on additional topics pertaining to that lot. So it was kind of like an alternative way of calculating house significations, or assigning significations to the house in a random way that was kind of chance-like or kind of not standard, because on the one hand, they had the standard method of assigning topics to the houses, which always had that, like, the fourth house is parents, and the fifth house is children, and the seventh house is marriage. But then you had these lots where, you know, by making it a little bit more random, those topics could fall in any of the 12 places or any of the 12 houses in a specific chart. And one person might have the lot of the father in the 10th house, whereas another one might have the lot of the father in the 6th house, and so on and so forth. So that's the primary way that lots were used. Do either of you, before I go on, do either of you have any points about that?
No, I don't think I have anything to add.
No, I think I'll just defer to your expertise here, Chris.
Okay, right. Yeah, I'm going to go on a whole, because I literally just got done writing an entire chapter on this. So,
and you're also fresh with it too. So,
yeah, it's really fresh in my mind. So I'm really fired up about it. And okay, so the second part of her related part of her question was, do whole sign house cusps work with Arabic parts? When rules for calculating Arabic parts like those below mentioned house cusps, what house systems would Greeks have been using? A book by Lind states that only equal house cusps work with Arabic parts, and many traditional websites showing show charts using Regiomontanus or Al-Kabish's house systems. So the latter part of my chapter on the lots, I did like a survey of many of the major lots that were commonly used in the Hellenistic tradition. And two of them that came up in Dorotheus were actually lots that involved house cusps. So one of them was the lot of, I think it was called the lot of possessions or something like that, the lot of finances. And in this lot, you were supposed to measure, and I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know if I'm misremembering it, but it's like measure from the lord of the second house up to the cusp of the second house, and then measure the same distance from the ascendant. So what it seems like they're doing there is actually they're using the beginning of the whole sign house cusp as the cusp of the second house. And he also has an eighth house. He has a lot of death where he does the same thing using the cusp of the eighth house. So, and looking at the sort of commentary for the translation of Dorotheus and Hephaestion of Thebes, Rob Hand actually has a little footnote on it, and he points out, he says, it looks like they're basically using the starting point of the whole sign house, which ends up being just the cusp or the beginning of the sign in order to calculate this lot. And this is probably partially also connected to, it seems like lots were originally calculated perhaps by sign first, and then eventually by degree. And in Dorotheus, it seems to be this mixture of the two where he's using the beginning of the sign as the house cusp, but then he's measuring the distance to the degree of the ruler as part of the sort of fundamental component of the lot. So, yeah, as far as we can tell, in some of the earliest authors that mention lots, when they do have lots that involve house cusps, I don't see any evidence of them. They don't say anything about, you know, calculating other house systems. They don't say anything about measuring it to the degree of certain cusps. They just seem to say measure it to the beginning of that house. And all of the context leading up to that seems to indicate that they're using whole sign houses, that they're using the signs themselves as houses. So naturally, the cusp or the starting point of the whole sign house is the starting point of the sign. So that changed later on, of course, when they started using Regiomontanus and Al-Kabishus and Porphyry and other things in the medieval tradition, because eventually the medieval astrologers inherited the concept and started using that. And then by the 9th century, there was this shift away from whole sign houses to using quadrant houses. And so they still had the old calculations, but then they started applying them in a quadrant house framework, which necessarily involved the cusps of the houses now being specific degrees somewhere falling in the signs themselves and not necessarily at the beginning of the signs. But anyways, as far as I can tell, it was the starting point of the whole sign house would be the cusp in terms of calculating the lot. Okay, so I don't suppose you guys don't have any comments about that, do you?
Nope.
Not on that piece, no. I might have a little to add on the next part, but I think you're the expert on that question.
Okay. So let's see. The next part of her question was, please explain the reasoning behind changing various Arabic part formulas for day and night births. Is this because of sect? For example, the importance of the part of fortune is being featured in current NeptuneCafe.com articles. And the author, Michael O'Reilly, clearly states, quote unquote, the author uses, he's referring to himself, I guess, the author uses the daytime formula and not the day-nighttime formula advocated by some. If you're using solar fire to calculate your part of fortune, the default setting is the misguided day-nighttime formula. And then she says, the importance of the part of fortune is highlighted in this guy's article, his many examples. So if he's not using the Knight formula for such personalities as Teddy Roosevelt, Barack Obama, Franklin Roosevelt, and John Kennedy, why does it work? Is he actually pointing to the part of spirit in these charts? And it's equally sensitive and informative, even though its character attributes are different. So I have a whole sort of set of notes and responses to this. Do you guys want to say anything before I launch into it?
I don't know. I have some stuff, but I don't want to. Why don't you go first?
Okay, I can give mine first, and if you want to add to that. Okay, so like I said earlier, the lots go back to the earliest strata of the Hellenistic tradition. And that's another point, is that, you know, in the past 10 or 20 years since the original concept was recovered, the people that, you know and are starting to use this concept call them lots for the most part, especially the people that have the background in the Hellenistic tradition. And the word part doesn't really convey the same meaning, even though it means the same thing in Latin. In English at this point, the term part doesn't really convey the original conceptual meaning underlying the concept. So I'm going to use the term lot, and I meant to say that from the start. So the lots go back to the earliest strata of the Hellenistic tradition, and there seems to have been some debates about how they should be calculated, even in the early part of the tradition. And this was partially arising from conceptual reasons and questions about whether they should be reversed based on the sect of the chart. That was usually the primary conceptual reason why they would be reversed or not reversed. But then there was also other debates that seemed to have arisen based on how to interpret some mysterious early source text that originally outlined or introduced the calculations for those lots. So Valens has this passage in the second century where he takes this quote from Nicepso, who is one of the earliest authors on horoscopic astrology, which is the type of astrology that uses the planet signs, houses, and aspects. And he's one of the mythical founders of the Hellenistic tradition, or supposed founders. So he takes this passage from Nicepso, and it's extremely difficult Greek, and it's written in a very cryptic, kind of riddling fashion. And Valens says, you know, many different authors have tried to understand this passage and figure out what the hell this author was talking about, but it's extremely difficult. And he gives the passage, and then he says, and here's my interpretation of what I think this means. And then he gives his interpretation. So one of the issues may be is that there was different interpretations of an early source text, and this led to some disagreement about how the lot should be calculated. Most of the Hellenistic astrologers, though, like Dorotheus, Valens, Paulus, Retorius, pretty much all of them seem to have reversed the calculation for the lot of fortune and many other lots for day and night charts. And then as a result of that, most of the medieval astrologers basically followed them. So the vast majority of the Western astrological tradition for about the first 1500 years or so pretty consistently reversed the calculation for the lot of fortune and the lot of spirit for day and night charts. Ptolemy was one of the only major Hellenistic astrologers who in the second century said that you should never reverse the calculation for the lot of fortune, but that you should always measure the distance from the sun to the moon and then project that same distance from the ascendant. So what happened, and this is kind of like a funny historical story, is that, you know, later astrologers basically ignored Ptolemy for most of the Hellenistic and medieval tradition, and they instead followed other astrologers like Valens and Dorotheus, who consistently reversed the calculation for day and night charts, so that in a day chart you measure the distance from the sun to the moon and then project that from the ascendant, and in a night chart you measure the distance from the moon to the sun and then project that from the ascendant. So most later astrologers in the Hellenistic and medieval tradition ignored Ptolemy until the Renaissance period. And then during the Renaissance period, there was this weird sort of short-lived back to Ptolemy movement with guys like William Lilly and some of his contemporaries, where Ptolemy was one of the earliest and one of the only Greek texts that survived all the way through until the 17th century. So they actually thought that Ptolemy and the approach of Ptolemy is kind of weird and kind of unique compared to some of the later medieval astrologers who were using approaches that were much more close to the mainstream Hellenistic tradition and mainstream authors like Dorotheus and Valens. So Ptolemy's approach appears kind of unique from that perspective. And so what happened is some of the Renaissance astrologers assumed that because Ptolemy's approach was kind of weird and unique, that it actually represented the older or the what was the mainstream approach originally early on before there were deviations in the later medieval tradition from the Arabic authors. So there was this back to Ptolemy movement where they started just adopting, you know, whatever sometimes very unique approaches Ptolemy had. And one of these included not reversing the calculation for the lot of fortune for day and night charts, even though everybody else largely did that. So, but the funny historical thing about that is that Lilly wrote what was the first textbook on astrology in English. Prior to that point, astrologers wrote their textbooks in Latin, even if English was their primary language. So as a result of that, Lilly's text had a huge influence on the subsequent English tradition all the way through into the 20th century. And for that reason, all the way through the 20th century, you have people, you have just the day calculation for fortune where you don't reverse it becoming the standard. And this has only changed recently in the past 20 or 30 years when suddenly we've started getting translations of some of the older Hellenistic and medieval texts besides Ptolemy. And researchers have realized that almost literally everyone besides Ptolemy was reversing the calculations for fortunes for the lot of fortune. So I wrote a paper a few years ago that's titled The Theoretical Rationale Underlying the Original Seven Hermetic Lots. And you can find this on my website or just do a Google search for it. And I actually discovered what the conceptual motivation is for reversing the calculation of the lot of fortune. And it actually has to do with this very interesting sort of philosophical premise where they seem to associate the lot of fortune with the concept of darkness and the concept of the body, whereas they had another lot that was often calculated along with fortune, which was the reverse of it, which they called the lot of spirit, which they associated with the concept of light and the concept of the soul or the intellect. So fortune indicates darkness in the body, and spirit indicates light and the soul and the intellect. And in that paper, you'll see what the rationale is for reversing the calculation for day and night charts, and it's all very interesting. So instead of going into that, I would just refer you to that paper, since it actually takes a fair bit of explaining to do, and you'll see what the rationale is, and then you can form your own opinion from there. But I would just caution people from following people that argue too strongly for this thing for one doing it one way or another, that don't have a good argument or a good conceptual argument underlying it, or where their argument sort of boils down just to, you know, arguments of textual superiority, because that's not usually a good argument to make if you're just saying, well, you know, this author says to do it and therefore I trust his authority or what have you. That's not really a good practical or conceptual reason to do what you're doing. And I would definitely caution people who sort of advocate that approach. So that's my take on it. What would you say, Kelly?
Well, you said it all so perfectly, Chris. No, for sure. The only thing I think is just that, yeah, my understanding is that the reasoning behind changing the formulas for day and night does have, certainly for the lot of spirit and lot of fortune, does have a little bit to do with the sect light of the time.
Right. So the sun in a day chart or the moon in a night chart?
Exactly. So for the lot of fortune, you know, it starts from the sun and goes to the moon in the day. And then for the night formula, it starts at the moon and goes to the sun. But your article, for anyone who does want to go further, your paper on the theoretical rationale or going into all of this is fascinating. And I didn't know the piece about the Ptolemy being translated first, which makes really good sense as to where that emerged and why at that particular time. That idea, I guess, of not reversing, which There are some traditional and then modern astrologers who are very passionate about the not reversing piece when it does seem to be the way they did it way back in the day.
Yeah, a lot of the Lily people today, the people that are, yes. You know, advocates.
The Lilyites, yeah.
The people that are, you know, students of or got into Lily, and that's one of their primary reference texts, and they're really into that approach to astrology and horary, which is actually kind of an interesting side topic, that this is becoming an interesting and sort of unexpected growing disparity in the traditional community, where it seems like you have the astrologers that are focused on and use as their primary basis the later part of the tradition, which is the astrologers around the time of the Renaissance, and especially the 17th century, which ends up focusing on Lily. Then you've got, you know, other people who focus on the Hellenistic tradition, which is sort of an emerging thing, which is 1700 years earlier, around the first century through the, let's say, fourth or fifth century. And there's enough, there was enough change in between those time periods, and there's enough disparity between those schools that that's actually becoming a much bigger disparity in terms of some contemporary astrological discussions than I anticipated like 5 or 10 years ago, where camps are becoming entrenched and people are like arguing about, you know, things like house division, like the debate that I had last year, which, you know, largely or partially arises from that disparity between somebody that's coming at it, you know, from the perspective of the 17th century and what makes sense within the context of 17th century astrology versus somebody that's coming at it from their perspective of first century astrology and what makes sense within that context. And there's a lot more disparity there than what one would think, given that oftentimes traditional astrology is sometimes mentioned as this thing that was, you know, much more consistent or much more like unified from the first century through the 17th century prior to the advent of modern astrology in the 20th century, which is then sometimes contrasted with as a less unified or more chaotic sort of approach. But in fact, there's a decent bit of disparity in traditional astrology as well. And even, I guess, the calculation of the lot of fortune is good evidence of this or good example of this. And I should say before, because this is the sort of traditional way that this issue has been dealt with as this debate's come up over the past 20 years after all these translations of text have been made. And there was this sort of realization that more astrologers were reversing the calculations and that was definitely the majority of astrologers compared to Ptolemy, who seemed somewhat unique. But in working on this and trying to be very careful about how I talked about it, In reconstructing the history of the issue for this chapter, I should say that there is actually much more ambiguity earlier in the tradition, so that we can't necessarily just reject the non-reversal argument completely, you know, because of like frequency of use or because most astrologers reversed it, whereas Ptolemy was one of the only major astrologers who didn't. Because when Valens actually quotes that passage from Petasiris, that's so cryptic and may have given rise to different astrologers interpreting it in different ways and therefore having different calculations for the lot of fortune. When Valens actually interprets it, he says, what I think this actually means in this cryptic passage is that you use the diurnal formula or the daytime formula for the lot of fortune in day charts, which is to measure from the sun to the moon and then the same from the ascendant. And then in night charts, you reverse it and you use the nocturnal formula where you measure from the moon to the sun, but he says, but only if the moon is above the ascendant-descendant axis in the top half of the chart, and that if the moon is below the ascendant-descendant axis in a night chart, that you default back to the diurnal calculation for the lot of fortune.
So that's really interesting, Chris. And the one thing I just wanted to throw in here on this topic is for people to maybe just remind themselves, because I think I agree with you in the idea of not throwing out the day formula for the lot of fortune, you know, because it sort of appears too consistently. There's a philosophical piece there that the formula for the lot of fortune by day is actually the moon phase. And since the lot of fortune, I believe, is the part based on the moon, there may be some philosophical piece in there that honoring the moon phase or giving it prominence in the chart, which is essentially what we do when we take the distance from the sun to the moon, project it off the ascendant, and then give it extra meaning. So I think there's definitely something to be said for, you know, it may not have just been a quirk that some people left it without changing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's sort of what I was getting at. That's a complicated and kind of nuanced issue. I mean, Valens presents that interpretation of the Nicepso and Pedicerus text, but then appears to ignore it, because in the rest of his chart examples, he always just flips the calculation for day and night charts, regardless of what side of the horizon the moon is on. But the point is that, you know, the origins of the concept and the technique may have been much more murky and much more up for debate, even if it did get sort of standardized by the time the Hellenistic tradition really picked up with the surviving texts that we have from Dorotheus and Valens and whoever else, and then all the subsequent medieval authors who largely just followed the earlier Hellenistic authors, such as Dorotheus and Valens, through their translations. So it's a complicated issue, requires additional research. I feel pretty strong about the approach of just reversing it, for the reasons that the conceptual reasons you can see outlined in that paper that I mentioned earlier on the origins of the significations of the theoretical rationale for the seven Hermetic lots, as well as for, and this relates to one of the next questions that she asks, which is how are the lots used in the Hellenistic tradition? And one of the ways they were used was in a complex timing technique called zodiac releasing, where you actually use the lot of fortune or the lot of spirit as a starting point for the timing technique. And that's where you actually see the reversal of the calculations used as being the most important and the most compelling or impressive. I don't usually, and this relates to another question that was asked in the next by Erna Alfors, where she asks, how do you use the Hermetic lots, and do you use them with perfections and transits, for instance? And you can, and many of the Hellenistic astrologers do use the lots within the context of perfections and transits, although I've mainly used them within the context of zodiac releasing. And I think that's where they're the most impressive, is within the context of that timing tech, where you really, that timing technique, where you really see what they're about and what they're capable of in a technique that's entirely based on them or entirely predicated on the position of the lot. And you know pretty clearly if you've got the lot in the right sign or if it's not in the right sign and something's off, because when the technique's working, it just works in this really stunning fashion typically. Whereas if the technique's not working, it's very clear that everything is off. So that's what I would say to that. Lisa, do you have any comments?
Yeah, the only other couple of things I had to say was, I was going to chime in with what you just said, which is, you know, evaluating which one's working, it kind of depends on what you're doing with it, rather than just seeing it as a static thing placed in a certain place in a chart. If you're using, I use the zodiacal releasing timing technique, like Chris, and if you're releasing from the lot of spirit, the timing is supposed to be related to peak periods and more positive and more challenging periods with respect to your career or your general life direction, whereas the one from the lot of fortune, it has to do more with the body. And so I feel like that's usually held up, I feel like that holds up with the day-night reversal. So I think it's important to, I don't know, evaluate things like that instead of just like interpreting it in a sign in a house or something. And the only other thing I had to add was kind of like the original person asking the question alluded to, is it actually pointing to the part of spirit in these charts when it's working or seeming significant, even if it's not reversed? And I would say that's really important because oftentimes, you're going to get another lot that's significant if you don't reverse it. It's not that you're going to get nothing. And so I think that can't be overlooked in terms of people sort of arguing for the other.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Lisa, that, yeah, if you don't reverse it, or, you know, the arguments for either way, if you don't reverse it, then the formula you use to calculate the lot of spirit is the reversal of the lot of fortune. So you end up with both parts or both lots in the chart regardless. I guess what you guys were saying is when you use them with zodiacal releasing, you'll really get a sense of whether you've called, you know, the lot of spirit correctly, the lot of spirit or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if you're just looking at it in the chart and saying, well, that's a significant point, well, it is going to be a significant point either way.
100%.
Yeah. And this has come up as really important and prominent in some charts recently, as I've been researching over the past couple of years, this issue of when exactly does it become day or night? Because there was always this assumption that it's like with the planetary hours, that it's right when the sun, you know, hits the ascendant and descendant axis. But I've actually been finding that that sometimes there's like a range to it. And sometimes it really becomes a day chart when the sun's a few degrees below the ascendant descendant axis, or just rising up over the ascendant, or even sometimes if it's just set below the descendant and it's still bright out, that it still behaves like a day chart. And therefore, the diurnal calculation of fortune and spirit still work very effectively in the context of zodiac releasing. So that's another instance where, you know, the reversal really makes a difference, and you can really tell. And there's charts like George Lucas, for example, where I think when you apply the zodiac releasing chart to his, or technique to his chart, that it's much more impressive if you do the reversal versus if you don't. All right. So that was the main sort of gist of a few questions from Marlene. She had a few other questions, but I think because I've spent so much time on this one, and because there's sort of different or unrelated questions, that we might want to move on so we can get to other ones. And maybe we can come back and do these again sometime or in another episode.
Sounds great.
Okay. So the next question was by Erna Alfors, and she had two questions, and I already asked the second one about the hermetic lots. But the first one she had is, she said, how do you interpret the malefics and the benefics too when they're rulers of the first or seventh houses? Do they still carry the malefic / benefic significations? So does either of you want to start with this one?
You can go, Kelly.
Okay, cool. I mean, I'm always happy to talk, but Lisa, did you want to say something?
I have things I can say, but I'll add to you.
Go for it. Go,
okay.
Go.
Well, the only thing I was going to say was, you know, yes, basically that they, the malefics and benefics do still carry significations, regardless of which house they're ruling. And seventh, it's more straightforward. So it can describe, like any other topic in the chart, the quality of how that area of life will go for you, or sort of describe the relationship partners or things like that. With the first house, it can be a little bit more complicated, only in that it represents you. And so it can sometimes be how you bring those qualities yourself to situations. And so, you know, like sometimes if it's a malefic or something, but it's ruling the ascendant, sometimes maybe like, especially whatever house that is then placed in, like maybe you bring some sort of issues to that area of life rather than it coming from other people in that area of life to you, if that makes sense. And the other thing is sometimes with the first house, it can pertain to health as well, since the first house also represents your body. So sometimes, and I've actually had, I'm still looking for additional tools to differentiate this if I don't know ahead of time or haven't talked to the person yet. Because sometimes it's not that the, like a malefic ruling the ascendant is like you being problematic. It's actually like your body being sort of problematic. And so there'll be some health issues, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was going to speak to that as well, Lise, because I actually just had a client this very week who had Saturn ruling her ascendant. And in the chart, Saturn was also placed in the sign of its detriment. So I guess there's a double factor there. But she had some kind of chronic and ongoing health conditions. So the malefic nature, if we like, is still there and just manifesting specifically to the topics in question.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, that's an important point in terms of, you know, is when it comes to the rulers of the houses, is the planet or its condition and what it signifies, is it just representing the circumstances? Sometimes it's just representing the circumstances surrounding that area of life. like Lisa was saying, to the extent that the first house signifies the body and the physical health and vitality, sometimes when the ruler of the ascendant is not in a good situation in the chart, it can indicate, you know, challenges or struggles surrounding physical matters or matters relating to the native's health. Whereas other times, if it's like a benefic and it's connected to the first house, it can, you know, quite literally mean positive things with respect to the body. And one of the, you know, my favorite things, one of the things I point out in my long, I think like 10-hour lecture on this in my Hellenistic astrology course, is one of the ways that that's sometimes traditionally interpreted or delineated, especially if there's a benefic like in the first house, is that there's something about the native's physical appearance or body that's like aesthetically pleasing or beautiful, so that the native is actually, you know, handsome or physically attractive in some way. And so I used the two examples of, the first one was the actor Paul Newman, who had, I think, Venus in the first house conjunct the degree of the ascendant. And in his obituary in the New York Times, he was said to be like strikingly handsome or something like that, or like eerily handsome. And then the female example I think I used was Angelina Jolie, who also had Venus conjunct the degree of the ascendant or something like that.
Yeah, she does. That's the example that came to my mind. Like, good old Angie and Venus.
Right. So there's that element of it in terms of, is it pertaining to that area of the person's life? And then the other way that it works out that I've been super interested in over the past few years, and Lisa mentioned this as well, is just the way that sometimes when you're talking about houses that represent people in the person's life, how sometimes the ruler of that house, whatever planet it is, the person represented by that house will take on the agency of that planet, or will sort of become the agent of that planet in the native's life. And so if this is, the one that's been the most interesting to me, and I think I've talked about a few times before on the show, is just how sometimes if it's a malefic planet that's the ruler of the ascendant, that because the first house represents the native and it's the house of self, and it's the house that's most closely connected with the native in the person's life versus the other houses representing everyone else, that sometimes when there's a malefic ruling the ascendant, especially if it's contrary to the sect, that sometimes the native can take on the agency of the malefic, and sometimes either cause problems in their own life in that certain area of life that it's placed, or cause problems for other people in some way in the area of life that it's placed in. So there's other manifestations of that, like Lisa mentioned. So I don't want to give the impression that that's always the case, but it's been really interesting for me studying the cases in which that is the case, and just seeing that as an interpretive principle, which doesn't just apply to the ascendant, because it also can apply to other, you know, houses. And so Erna asked about the seventh house, and sometimes it's the same thing, where if a malefic is the ruler of the seventh house and it's poorly placed in the chart, and let's say contrary to the sect, sometimes it's like the native's partner becomes the agent of the malefic and imports, you know, difficult things or misfortune or problems into the native's life in some specific area. Like, I remember last year I got really excited about the example of Steven Spielberg, where I think, if I remember correctly, it's like he had a malefic ruling the seventh house and it was placed in the second. And when it got activated by annual perfections, he had like a famous, like most costly divorce in history, because it's like in that instance, at least, his partner from his subjective standpoint became the sort of malefic that was sort of taking away, you know, his money or what have you. But that works when it comes to the rulers of other houses as well. Like if, you know, you have a malefic ruling the fifth house of children and it's somehow poorly placed in the chart, and somehow the native's children, you know, cause them problems, or the native's friends if it's the 11th house or what have you. And of course that works in the reverse. If it's a benefic and it's extremely well placed, it's like those people playing very positive roles in your life or somehow helping you or bailing you out or what have you, so that it can go both ways. So that's just a particularly interesting area of research for me in terms of the way that that can sometimes work out in very literal ways, even though it's otherwise just a sort of a broader symbolic placement where you're just taking a few very basic techniques or concepts and then putting them together, and it produces this delineation, which then can sometimes work out very literally. So, okay, I think we covered that one pretty well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so let's move on to question number 5 by Theodora Gales. And this is one where I should probably read out the full question, because like her sort of background is part of it, or is important context for the actual question itself. So unless one of you wants to read it, I mean, either of you want to read it?
Do you want me to read it to give your voice a break?
Sure. Might as well. Go ahead.
Okay, cool. So when I first set eyes on my birth chart, I had no idea what Placidus meant. I had no idea that there are other systems of house division anyway. So I got used to my planets being in certain houses, and I became accustomed to seeing myself through a certain type of lens. I had no clue that life could look any different. Fast forward a couple of months, and here I am diligently studying astrology. Traditional astrology draws my attention. I learn about the whole sign houses, and I have a shock. Welcome to the club. That's my insert. My chart looks different when I change the house system. Actually, it always looks different no matter what house system I use. My north node, for example, sits either in the 3rd, the 4th, or the 5th house. How about that? Truth be told, I've come to pay more attention to the whole sign houses because they seem to be more accurate. That being said, what strikes me is that no matter what house system I use, the main themes never change. And the question specifically is, so my question is, how would you approach a chart that is so changeable? How could you not lose confidence when no two house systems yield the same result?
Right. So this is, you know, a really important question that I think every astrologer, or at least every thinking astrologer, like struggles with at some point in their career, especially, you know, when they first start learning astrology, or sometimes at different points in their studies as an astrologer. I mean, I know, or I think I dealt with it a little bit because of the way the different house systems change my chart. Some of the different quadrant systems do. Do you guys remember struggling with it either before the whole sign house sort of exposure, or even during?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I had a major problem adopting whole sign houses, which is what I use now, but there was quite a long period of me questioning and not being sure if that was the right way to go and that kind of thing.
I was a little the opposite, only because my chart doesn't really change. I have pretty even houses and a fairly early degree rising, so nothing. I think the one thing that changes my midheaven ruler, actually, and unfortunately it pops into the 6th, but obviously it still works. But I've dealt with a lot of students when I made the transition to whole sign houses myself personally in my own practice first, and then I changed my teaching program to teach in whole sign houses. And then to go back to some of my senior students, we did have to work through a few things. Cause for some people, as this particular listener is asking, there are some very significant changes.
Do any of the house systems really change anything significant in your chart, Kelly?
Only the midheaven ruling planet, Jupiter. So it's at 0 Leo, but in Placidus, that would be at the end of the 5th house.
Okay.
And in, of course, whole sign, it's in the 6th. Thankfully, though, it has the amelioration of being in a trine aspect to the midheaven degree.
Right.
But that's it. That's the only thing that changes.
Okay. So it wasn't like a huge shift for you in terms of your personal chart, but maybe in terms of clients and stuff?
Yeah, for some clients and for students as well. And that's been really interesting. It's also helped me better understand how, you know, they always say, if you want to learn something, teach it. You know, working with students and when they first encounter their chart, I'd say to them, you know, do the topics of X house seem more relevant around this planet? You know, maybe it's their midheaven ruling planet, and maybe it's either in the 8th or the 9th. And based on the kind of work they can do or they're doing, we can very clearly see which one is actually more accurate for them. And obviously it's always been the whole sign, so that's why I've kept up with it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so this has become it's not become an issue. This has always been an issue. This has been an issue in the astrological tradition for 1,000 years, because astrologers have been arguing about it for about 1,000 years. And in modern times, I don't know if you'd say that that's heightened, but certainly I think with the advent, because one of the points that James Holden made in his book, I think, A History of Horoscopic Astrology, was that he tried to argue, or he just said sort of blatantly based on his reading of different books, different astrology books, that the reason why the house system Placidus became so popular in the 20th century is because it was the only house system that there were tables available for much of the, I think, earlier mid 20th century. And so he said that because you need, for certain house systems, you need books of tables in order to be able to calculate them correctly. And so he said the availability of those tables is one of the reasons why Placidus became popularized and became sort of the standard or the default house system for many astrologers in the 20th century. But I think with the, certainly even before that time, you know, this was an issue, but certainly with the advent of computerized chart calculation software and programs and the ability of astrologers to calculate different house systems on the fly, with, you know, online programs like AstroDienst, where you have 10 or 15 different forms of house division to choose from, even though it defaults to Placidus, you can change it to, you know, Porphyry or Equal or what have you, that this becomes, I don't want to say more of a pressing issue, but it's a much clearer issue that you have a number of different house systems to choose from in the past 20 or 30 years. And nobody really seems to have, you know, great arguments for why you should use one house system or another, because a lot of the origins of the different forms of house division have to do with different sort of mathematical models for schematizing, you know, how you should measure what the houses should be measured relative to, or how you should trisect or divide into three the different quadrants between the angles and different things like that. So that a lot of the arguments in modern times, but even over the past 1,000 years, have been largely mathematical arguments that are very abstract and don't really get to the heart of, you know, what is the conceptual reason why we have this house system, or what is the conceptual reason why we have this house system, or what would make a person conceptually use, you know, this house system or another form of house division. And there hasn't been, I don't feel like, a lot of that type of discussion. And that's one of the things that makes the house division issue so questionable and so nebulous, is there's a lack of sort of like concrete conceptual arguments for different house systems. And one of the things that I found really interesting, especially last year when the whole house division debate started, is I've been noticing that part of the way that astrologers are dealing with this is by sort of importing, you know, certain political philosophies over almost into the astrological techniques, where, you know, a lot of astrologers tend to have more sort of liberal sort of political philosophies, where there's this sense of, like, you know, wanting to promote openness and diversity and, you know, just the point of view that everything is good, and that there's different approaches, and that everybody can sort of like live and let live, and there can be multiple different, you know, sort of approaches to life that are fine and that can kind of coexist at the same time. And in some ways, it's like that philosophy has been imported into and applied recently to this debate about house division, where sometimes, you know, because people don't have necessarily really like conceptual arguments for, you know, using one form of house division over another, it just sort of becomes this thing of there's just different ways that people do it. And, you know, it would be best to just to live and let live, and that, you know, it's all good and it's all valid. And, you know, everybody has different subjective experiences of life, and therefore will gravitate towards one house system or another or something like that. And there's a certain level where I'm like sympathetic to that, in the sense of, I think it's kind of lame when astrologers get too militant about, you know, promoting some specific variant of astrology that they find to be particularly effective. And there's something that's kind of like counterproductive or kind of off-putting to me about sometimes like arguments like that. So that in that sense, I have a certain level of sympathy for that approach to dealing with the house division issue. And I think most of the time it's appropriate. But At the same time, this is like a technical issue that has practical ramifications. And there's a certain level where if the entire debate is just sort of dismissed in that way as, you know, live and let live and everything works and it's all the same, I feel like that's kind of a cop-out and it's kind of avoiding the issue and kind of sidestepping the issue rather than actually dealing with it head on by trying to figure out either if there are different systems that are more effective or if there's different ways that multiple systems can be true or accurate, but just in different ways or just when applied to different things or to different measurements. Like maybe different house systems have specific uses, perhaps, is one theory that some people have. So one of my things has just been wanting to understand what the conceptual motivation is underlying what we're doing in astrology. And that's true of house division, but as I sort of demonstrated or talked about a little bit earlier, that's also true in other areas. Like when you come to that debate about whether the lots should be reversed or not, I have a specific sort of philosophical or conceptual rationale that I found that I think was part of the original rationale in the texts that motivated why they flipped the calculations for spirit and fortune. And I'd like to ideally have similar conceptual rationales for why I use whatever form of house division I use as well. And that is actually a large part of what I was attempting to do last year when I gave the original talk on whole sign houses, despite the fact that I ended up, you know, marketing it in a certain way that was very over the top. I thought it was supposed to be obvious that I was doing that kind of tongue in cheek. Although that's really funny that Lisa actually, you warned me, like people are not going to get that that's supposed to be tongue in cheek at the time, right?
Yeah, I was like, maybe you don't want to say it that over the top and people won't, not everyone will realize you're joking.
Right. And I was like, but if I say literally the best form of house division ever, like people will obviously, you know, understand that I'm being slightly facetious here and that that's sort of, you know, supposed to get your attention. And then I'm supposed to draw you in and actually present some of my arguments. But then at the end of the lecture, say my ultimate conclusion that ended up getting overlooked by several people was that it doesn't matter what form of house, well, it was two conclusions. One was that it doesn't matter what form of house division you use, as long as you have a good reason for doing it. And as long as you have some good, you know, conceptual or philosophical motivations for why you're using that specific form of house division rather than some other form of house division or practical reasons or what have you, you know, then I'm okay with that. But it's more what I was trying to do was sort of lead by example by showing, you know, this is a set of reasons why I use whole sign houses and why I think it's compelling, you know, in addition to whatever practical reasons that I have in terms of my experience as an astrologer and feeling like that's an effective approach. So that was part of the other part of it, of course, was that I also said that I do think that part of the path forward is not everybody, you know, giving up every alternative form of house division and everybody switching to whole sign houses, which I feel is a little bit kind of what's happening lately. But in fact, that the path forward in the area that I'd be focusing on researching is how to sort of reconcile some of the different forms of house division and how to perhaps integrate quadrant houses in a sense into whole sign houses so that you're using them both in a way that seems consistent and seems sort of conceptually compelling, not in just a sense of like that you're doing everything or you're using all of the same systems at the same time just for the sake of it, but as a way to actually solve the issue by recognizing there are legitimate pieces to both approaches and figuring out what the legitimate pieces are and then finding a way to use the best of both worlds. So that was kind of my conclusion. I didn't really expect that, you know, I should have probably anticipated that there were going to be proponents of quadrant houses that were going to freak out over that argument and then sort of launch tirades on me for promoting whole sign houses. Because there's basically some people that really react in a super negative way to that concept when their entire career and sort of life's work is based around doing one approach. And then there's this new approach that comes in and says that, you know, it should be done a different way. Obviously, you're going to have some people that react negatively to that. And I guess I sort of underestimated how that discussion would go. And that's had some repercussions even recently, where it's been interesting to me how the debate has gone, where some people seem to be picking up that argument and sort of taking it in a new direction, where it's becoming much more sort of like combative, like quadrant houses against whole sign houses, than I think I ever anticipated or than I ever wanted it to go in terms of my lecture or the way that I actually conceptualized things, despite otherwise sort of promoting the lecture as if it was going to be this polemical sort of argument. But to sort of wrap this up, I mean, I guess I've made most of my points, which is just that I think there should be a good conceptual reason for using whatever you use. I don't think it's a good argument to say that because, you know, William Lilly used this house system, that's the house system that I'm going to use. I don't think that's compelling intellectual or conceptual argument any more than somebody saying, you know, Vadius Valens used this system and therefore that's the approach that I'm going to use. I don't think those are compelling arguments. So, you know, it's hard for different astrologers, especially if you're new to astrology, to research all of the issues related to house division and to really get into this in a deep way, so that you've researched like 20 different forms of house division and then decided that you want to settle on this one. I realize that that's not something that you can really do, especially if you're a newer astrologer. But I guess I would just recommend understanding that, broadly speaking, there's basically like three different forms to house division. There's the whole sign approach, there's equal houses, and then there's the quadrant approach. And the difference between these three, there's many differences, but a lot of it really boils down to the difference between how to treat the midheaven. Like in whole sign houses, the midheaven is the 10th sign relative to the rising sign. In equal houses, the midheaven is exactly the 90 degree point upwards from the ascendant. And in quadrant houses, the midheaven is the intersection between the meridian and the ecliptic, which is sort of a separate astronomical concept. But one of the things that I've been moving towards is just the realization that there's a place for all three of those measurements in some sense. It's just a matter of figuring out, you know, which ones you want to integrate and what each of them mean. From my perspective, I'm very, you know, after having started out with Placidus and quadrant houses and used that for the first 4 or 5 years of my study and being very dismissive of and rejecting whole sign houses initially for, I think, the first year after I heard about it, before eventually coming around after seeing the way that it was so well integrated into the rest of the system, like I was saying earlier, through the zodiac being sort of like the backdrop or the backbone of the entire system, and that applying to the aspect doctrine as well as houses, as well as the lots or Arabic parts and perfections and zodiac releasing and all these other different parts of the system, where the zodiac was sort of underlying everything and sort of holding it up in some sense. To me, eventually, it wasn't just the practical demonstration of that working when I actually started trying it in chart work and seeing it work in transits or in planetary placements or in electional charts or what have you. But it was also just conceptually that there was something compelling to me about that as an overall system or an overall approach to astrology. And I'm not sure that it would be as compelling outside of that overall approach. But that's why I think in each instance, when you're talking about different forms of house division, that you have to understand not just what the approach is, but also, you know, what type of astrology it arose from and how it would have been practiced by people that developed it originally at that time. And then if you study it in that context and come to an understanding of it, then you can maybe sort of develop a more informed decision about the merits of it. So I could keep going and going, but one of you should cut me off at this point.
I actually have a bunch of points, so I could go. Okay, so I have a little bit of overlap with what Chris said. He's a little bit more conceptually oriented, whereas I'm often very practically oriented in terms of what I see working hands-on. So I had a couple points that were more on the practical side and then a couple points on the more big picture side. So one of the practical points is sometimes it's easier to resolve questions of what seems to be working in a chart when you're looking at sort of concrete events or external specific circumstances. And I know that's not everything of what people are interested in seeing in charts, but it's often phrased in terms of personality traits. And with personality, it's much harder to say something is definitively false, I think, because you're juggling so many different factors. So unless something is like so way off, like you're really shy and there's something in your chart that says, you know, no, you're like super, you know, like ebullient and outgoing, then, you know, okay. But overall, I think it's harder to falsify personality traits. So one of my practical suggestions would be to look at sort of like more concrete circumstances as well as external events. And one of the ways you can do that, as my second point, is people often talk about these different house systems in terms of planets in the houses changing. I hear that a lot. I don't hear a lot of people focusing on the house rulers as much. I'm sure some people do, but usually I hear this discussion in terms of, well, it moves my Mercury from the 8th to the 9th or things like that. And I would suggest, as a good way to kind of test some of this, focusing more on the rulers of the houses and using timing to watch it. And so, for instance, watching when house rulers get exact transits and see what happens and what particular themes come up, which house themes come up, or watching like annual perfections activating certain placements. So that's one of my sort of just like practical suggestion. The other is it really helps to use all the rules together. So not just saying, you know, what does Mercury in the ninth mean, but saying, or Mercury is maybe not the best one. Say maybe what does, you know, Mars in the ninth mean, and using that with the rules of sect, using it with the rules of, you know, like malefic and benefic, and then which areas of life that's in and ruling, and seeing, are those areas of life particularly difficult to me? If I, for instance, have a day chart and I'm looking at Mars, or are those areas of life particularly beneficial for me if I have Venus there and it's a night chart? So using it with those other rules, I think it's really useful, unless the same planet rules both houses, such as Capricorn and Aquarius being ruled by Saturn, for instance. So those are my practical suggestions. And that kind of plays into one of the things that Chris said, and that, you know, all of those things were developed with whole sign houses, and so they do work really well together. So, I mean, I'm suggesting that on the one hand as a way to test your house system, but it also could be that, like he was saying, that some tools work better, some tools work better with a particular house system, or with a particular, what are you looking to do with that house system? So that's on the practical side. On the bigger picture side, I really think the larger problem, and I hope this isn't like completely obvious, but I think the larger problem often seems to me, how do we acknowledge that there's multiple angles on the truth that can show valid things without, on the other hand, completely defaulting to anything goes? And that's, you know, on the one hand, I think it does bear repeating, even if it's obvious to some people, because I think oftentimes some people act like that can't be true, that two things can't be true, you know, and so people end up in sort of like spurious arguments where it's coming from the angle of, if my system works and I know that I can see it working, then your system must not. And I think that's... Right. That's not useful, and there's just like a lot of air wasted on those arguments when they, you know, it's like a false assumption to begin with. But So I think it is possible to say that something works really well without having to simultaneously assert that everything else must be false, therefore. But it's tricky because also, like Chris was saying earlier, you don't really want to get into the complete loose anything goes or like it's all good or that sort of thing, because, you know, it is a technical thing. You know, we are working with a technical system. And so there should be some things that seem, you know, more correct than others. But that kind of goes back to what I was saying with the personality versus external events, you know, some things being more easily falsifiable. So, but I think that that's, you know, a good bigger picture thing to keep in mind, you know, to not get into inessential arguments by just sort of like being black and white about it, but also to still keep your critical function and not assume that because multiple things can work, that everything works. And I think that it's a good thing to acknowledge that that's actually a somewhat challenging thing for human beings in any realm. And, you know, to not get down on yourself if you can't figure it out or, you know, because I think, I think that realm of existence is hard, acknowledging multiple truths, but still having a critical faculty, I guess. And then the final thing I would say is, you know, even though it is frustrating, I certainly think it's frustrating. I would like to have one answer. I don't think it necessarily has to be fully resolved as long as you do, you know, test whatever you're working with well and see that it seems to be working well and consistently. You know, and it's possible that different house systems do show different things or different facets of your life. And one of the examples for me is I've noticed, for example, watching outer planet transits over time, every time like a quicker planet comes around and sets that longer transit off, it seems to be having manifestations in the whole sign house and in the quadrant house simultaneously for me on two entirely different topics. And so that's something that's sort of like an ongoing thing that I'm watching. But I think that's potentially sort of like a good thread of an example that multiple things can work, but then it's still a matter of sort of, sort of developing what you're doing really well. And, you know, maybe you don't have to do everything. And I think that's more of the practical piece again, because, you know, there's only so much time. So I don't prepare, you know, every client's chart in a whole sign system and in a Placidus system. You know, it's just, there's just not enough time to look at everything, but to maybe be to research on the side, but also be simultaneously content with developing your own system really well that you do see working. So I guess those are the points that question made me think of.
Yeah, really interesting points, Lisa. The one that I really wanted to hone in on, which is one that you explained beautifully, and I'll just throw in a little second here just to really emphasize it for the listeners, is that idea of using all the rules together. So many times people will say, well, this whole sign system or this system, it can't be true because then this planet is in this house and that means that area of my life should be good or bad.
Right.
And what you're saying there is that there's a lot more to an area of life being air quote good or air quote bad. I mean, I think it might be better to say functional or not functional. There's a lot more to that functionality of the different areas of life according to the rules of the houses than just the house placement of the ruling planet. And one area that has really helped confirm, if you like, for me, that worked example, I like the point you said, Lisa, about personality traits are a little bit more fudgeable or permeable. But if you look at particular, there are different topics in life that are more clear cut. And one of those that I work with a lot is fertility and conception, children, which is a fifth house topic. So one can either be functionally fertile or not. There's not a lot of gray area there. And so working with the ruler of, you know, the whole sign fifth house, for instance, can help clarify that if you, you know, and that topic is one that is less, there's less gray area around it. You know, you either can conceive easily or you can't. So there may be some areas of the chart that could be a little bit more black and white that may be better for beginners to sort of be testing out. But I do think it's not just, you know, the house of, you know, the ruling planet of the fifth house. You'd also need to check it out for, you know, some strength indicators or speed indicators, or use all the rules together. I thought that was a really beautiful point, Lisa.
Definitely. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, for beginner astrologers, or, you know, a lot of modern astrologers that are dealing with this topic. I feel like it often boils down to only, you know, it shifts a planet from one house to another, and what the interpretation of that planet is in terms of being in, like, let's say, like the ninth house versus the 10th house, or being in the second house versus the third house or something like that. And one of the ones that people do often overlook that was mentioned earlier is just the rulers and the rulers of the houses. Sometimes, you know, I've noticed one of the things that people are resistant to in terms of switching from quadrant to whole sign is certain chart placements that they've come to identify in their life. But then it turns out that sometimes the same delineation or the same interpretation is already present in their chart from another perspective using whole sign houses, just by looking at the rulers of the houses and how they're placed. And that sometimes you can have things, sort of echoes of the same placement that show up in different ways in different systems. So you have to be kind of careful when you're evaluating charts on that basis, because sometimes, you know, if you think that one system changes your chart to be in a way that's different and perhaps worse because it looks like you lose something, you should make sure that that's not something that's being sort of repeated somewhere else in a different way using the other system. And that's kind of a really ambiguous point that I'm not sure will make any sense. But
I think that made a lot of sense. Yeah. And, you know, especially if you don't know, excuse me, all the rules yet, you might not even see how it's showing up in a different way for you. If you use a different house system, you might just see the surface of it's in that house instead of the other house, and not all the sort of back alleys and things of how it could still be manifesting that same theme in a different way.
Yeah. So I feel like house divisions become a much more prominent thing. There's been some major developments in it in the past month that I don't want to go into right now, but Austin actually pointed out to me privately that when the whole house division thing sort of happened last year in November on the podcast, that Saturn was exactly squaring Neptune at the time when I was releasing some of those episodes. And then the Saturn-Neptune square again occurred this month in June when some other developments started happening with that. And I thought that was kind of interesting and appropriate and maybe insightful on some level, that there may be something about house division that, you know, almost is like of like a Saturn-Neptune type flavor, because you have this real difference between these two different drives of, like, on the one hand, wanting to, like, establish a specific, like, external truth-based, you know, approach or, like, system, like figuring out what is externally valid in terms of an approach, versus this as sort of like a Saturn thing, versus like Neptune as sometimes being the fact that sometimes things are more nuanced or more flexible or more ambiguous than we would like sometimes. And what happens when those two realms collide of, like, you know, the things that are objective, externally true, versus the things that are, you know, subjective and nebulous and, like, uncertain, and what happens when there's tensions between those two realms. And house division is one of those areas in astrology that's just symbolically is very much like that in some ways, because there's this element to it where there might be objective ways in which some systems work better or are more effective or more useful for certain things than others. But then there might be this other way in which multiple systems could work in different ways, or could have overlapping uses in some sense, or where there could be ways that different systems are valid in some sense that don't necessarily have to conflict or be, like, mutually exclusive. So we may not be solving this issue immediately right now, because there's something about like the nature of that. If Saturn-Neptune contacts, or the Saturn-Neptune cycle is sort of fully actually tied into this issue in that way, it may not be something that's fully reconcilable. But I would hope, you know, as we continue going through that square at different points, that perhaps we'll start to get a slightly better grasp on how to resolve those two different areas of life sort of coming into conflict at this time. All right. So did we give that an adequate treatment? I don't know if we left things in a better shape than when we left them, or if we just made them worse. What do you guys think?
No, I think those were some good tips and thoughts to work with.
Yeah. And the other piece too is there isn't an absolute answer here. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's sort of what comes up again and again, is in different circumstances or with a different philosophy, you could apply a different technique and still have a useful result. There's no absolute result, but the point, I guess, really is this useful in some way?
Sure. Yeah. And I'm sure this will be something that we return to in the future on future episodes.
For sure.
Since obviously there's a lot to say about it, and there's a lot of new research and things that still need to be explored and sort of discussed more broadly. And at some point, I mean, this is a chapter that I'm working on in the book about, you know, what was the original system of house division, or what were the original systems of house division? How were they used? What are the origins of this whole debate? And, you know, how can that help us to inform and sort of reconcile that debate today? So that might be something that I return back to if I get the courage to later this summer at some point. All right. How are we doing for time in terms of how many questions we have left to go through?
We may have to pick a couple because we seem to be giving some really detailed responses. So I don't know if there are any that really stood out to you guys that you would prefer to look at.
How much time do we have left to go through?
I think we have about 25 minutes.
Okay. I mean, I feel like I really have to address the next one. I mean, I know it's going to be a longer one, but I can try and do it.
Well, maybe that's the next one. And if it takes that time, that's what needs to be addressed. And we can hold the other questions for a future episode.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. And if we have any more time left after that one, I love the one after that about the bad houses.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So we've got our plan for the next little bit.
Yeah. We'll try and get through the next two questions. All right. So the next question came from listener and patron Erica Jones. She had a long sort of email, and I want to read the whole thing just for the sake of making sure all of her points are in there, because of the way that she sort of framed the question, and I want to make sure I convey that correctly. Okay. So she said, on episode 64, the significations of the seven traditional planets, you said something to the effect that the Tarnesians, parentheses, presumably meaning practitioners of archetypal astrology and cosmology as taught by Richard Tarnas, are guilty of conflating mythology with astrological archetypes, or perhaps overly relying on mythologies to derive planetary symbolism. At least that's what I understood you to say. If I did understand that correctly, I'm curious what you mean by that. I studied with Tarnas for 3 years at the California Institute of Integral Studies in the master's program, which he founded there, and he never taught us that we should restrict our thinking to the planet Jupiter to Zeus, or the planet Venus to Aphrodite, or the planet Pluto to Kali. He never really deviated from what he set forth in Cosmos and Psyche, in which, following a long discourse on the nature of the archetype and giving three means by which it may be understood, Homeric as a primordial deity or mythic figure, Platonic Pythagorean as a cosmic and metaphysical principle, and then Jungian as a psychological principle, Tarnas states, and then she quotes Tarnas from Cosmos and Psyche, "For all the planets, both those known to the ancients and those discovered in the modern era, the body of evidence we'll be examining points to the existence of transcultural archetypal principles that inform and encompass the observed synchronistic patterns of meaning." That was a tongue twister. So the specific mythic deities of the more local cultural mythologies, such as the Greek or Roman, appear to represent particular inflections of these transcultural archetypes. The Greco-Roman figures and narratives are resonant with significance for the Western cultural imagination, but ultimately seem to be best understood as culturally specific embodiments of more universal archetypal principles. page 89, emphasis added. This is a pretty clear statement. So this is Erica again. She says, this is a pretty clear statement that we shouldn't think strictly in terms of local myth when engaging the planetary archetype, but rather understand the perception of any special resonance in terms of our own cultural history. Indeed, beware of bias, and to make the effort to discern and articulate more universal qualities of the archetype. In that part of episode 64, you also said the conflation of myth with planetary archetype is a bit of a hobby horse for you, so I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, perhaps within the context of addressing the error of the Tarnesians. Okay, so all right, so here's the deal with that. So I said that was a bit of a hobby horse for me because about 11 years ago, when I first started studying Hellenistic and medieval astrology at Kepler College, I was actually surprised to find out that they didn't really seem to resort to myth as an interpretive tool as much as I would expect, given how common that has become in modern astrology. So I wrote like a little, I don't know if it wasn't a term paper, it was probably a little homework assignment on that topic at the time. And I posted that on my blog a few years later on the Horoscopic Astrology blog under the title On the Use of Mythology in Astrology. So you can kind of see the argument that I make there. So the point is that it turns out that approach has really only become commonplace in the past 40 years or so in the West of using mythology as an interpretive tool or as a core interpretive tool or device in astrological delineations and consultations and in order to understand the meaning of planetary significators or other celestial bodies for that matter. So I will say it was probably unnecessary to single out the Tarnus school in particular, since it's not something that's restricted or necessarily unique to them, because that approach has become popular among many astrologers many modern astrologers who are influenced by Jung, of which Liz Green is a really popular and good example, and perhaps even more prominent example than students of Tarnus. And then more recently, others like Demetra George and others who work with the asteroids and other minor planetary bodies or other celestial bodies. So I mentioned the students of Tarnus in particular just because I'd recently seen a book, and it seemed like part of the premise of archetypal astrology is that the archetypes of the planets would bleed through into reality in many different ways, including mythology. And so at the core of this school, there was this sort of rationalization of why the use of myth is and should be a core interpretive device in astrology. So that came up, or that comment actually came up in that particular show, because I had noticed not too long before that Ciaran Le Gris had recently published an entire book on Eris, and it seemed like he was using the mythology associated with the god Eris as one of his primary access points for understanding the astrological meaning of the planet. And one of his longer chapters in that book actually takes that approach where, and I have a quote from the beginning of the book, he says, quote unquote, because he's outlining his principles for how he's going to understand the meaning of this newly discovered planetary body, which was just discovered a few years ago, and then he wrote a book on it already in 2012. So he says, quote unquote, an examination of the other planets suggests that there's a connection between the archetypal meaning of a planet and the mythological associations with the planet's name, which might be disclosed through an exploration of myths featuring the corresponding god or goddess through intuitive sources such as revelation, dreams, or active imagination, as well as through works of art and literature. By considering the myths featuring the goddess Eris, therefore, we will consider how these myths might illuminate the meaning of the Eris archetype in astrology. So this is primarily what I was referring to in terms of specifically referring to, you know, students of Tarnus and how students of Tarnus were sometimes taking the, you know, this new archetypal approach to astrology, which, you know, mythology is a relatively significant or can be a major part. And they were using that in order to inform things like, you know, what are the significations of newly discovered planetary bodies? And one of my objections to this approach, just in general, just in the astrological community in general, you know, students of Tarnus aside, is just that it seems like it's led astrologers to develop preconceptions about what the celestial body means before any actual empirical work has been done. And there's something about relying on the synchronistic coincidence of the name and the related stories over or instead of the empirical observations that makes me a little bit uneasy. I'm not really clear that this was necessarily done with Uranus, and the stories about people like John Varley seem to emphasize the empirical observations in terms of developing an understanding of that planet more before any sort of like mythological associations were brought into play. And I think that's actually perhaps why even Tarnas himself would later question whether the mythology of another story, the story of Prometheus, would actually fit better for the meaning of Uranus. And if anything, that a little bit, I think I already mentioned this in the previous show, that kind of is one of the things that even points to me how, you know, sometimes the mythology isn't something that you can fully rely on, when even somebody advocating that approach says, you know, in this instance, there's this other myth that actually seems to fit our empirical understanding of Uranus more than the name that actually got associated with it by some astronomers in, you know, a few centuries ago. So I guess my point here is just cautioning that it's assumed that this approach has always been done, but in fact, it's relatively recent. And the fact that astrologers are using that to inform their fundamental initial meaning of new planetary bodies makes me a little bit uneasy, because I think it might overshadow the empirical work, which potentially could be more important in developing our understanding of the planetary meanings of these new bodies. And that's what I was referring to in that instance, specifically because I had just recently gotten a copy of that new book on Eris, where it seemed like that was one of the primary approaches being taken. So that's my response to that. And you can see that paper that I mentioned earlier on my blog, which shows an older sort of, you know, my view of this initially about 10 years ago, which is titled On the Use of Mythology in Astrology. All right. Do you guys have any comments about that?
No, I think that was all you and beautifully said.
Yeah. I mean, and the question was directed at
a comment you'd made in an earlier episode. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can move on. So the next question, does anybody want to read this one?
I'll read it because I know Lisa's really keen to answer it.
Okay.
So I'll just read the first point, which I think is what we'll probably focus on. So it's from Margarita Stoffberg, who's asking about the bad houses. And she says, on a personal note, I have attached my chart with the plethora of 12th house planets. I do understand you work with whole signs, so you'd move Mercury into the first, although do bear with me as I've seen a 12th house Mercury affect all my relationships. Anyway, that's beside my question. My question is there such a thing as a non-scary 12th, 6th, or 8th house when there's a concentration of benefics there? If so, what can we expect more specifically related to the 12th house? As I would imagine making use of other resources as well as good health would come from good 8th and 6th. But she's really wondering about the 12th house and what good could possibly come from that.
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question, and it's also a really good distinction to make with the benefics there, because a lot of times sort of the 12th house is sort of more casually referred to, especially in modern astrology, as the sort of the spiritual house or that sort of thing, meditation and stuff like that. And you know, actually, especially if you're using a whole sign house system and you don't have good placements in the 12th house, it can be really difficult topics. A lot of the most difficult topics in life are given to the 12th, also the 6th and the 8th. And so, you know, prisons and hospitals and, you know, chronic illness and things like that. So, but I've seen great examples of benefics both in and ruling the 12th house, as well as like other exalted planets, like exalted Saturn in the 12th and things like that, being really nice manifestations of the 12th house. So for instance, I've seen doctors with that placement because they're working with people who are ill. I've seen people who volunteer in prisons with good placements in the 12th.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to bring some benefit to the people in the 12th house circumstance. And then I've also seen people with the benefics surrounding the 12th house with that's when the spiritual or contemplative practices really do come in, that I've seen is people with strong contemplative practices often do have nice 12th houses. So I think a common major difference with the benefics there is that people are working with others going through those difficulties that that house describes, rather than they themselves going through those difficulties personally. And sometimes with benefics there, it's like sometimes even this sounds bad, but it's not really. It's sometimes getting some benefit from other people's difficulties, such as, you know, one's job being working with the sick and therefore getting paid for that, rather than being sick themselves. So that's a lot of what I've seen. And then the sixth and the, let's see, oh, actually a couple of good examples. Yeah, I had the doctor one. Another one was the ruler of the seventh was like a benefic in the 12th. And it was someone who has a very spiritual partner who is nonetheless also very reclusive and has some ill health issues. So, you know, it can also be related to the particular house rulers that are there. And then the sixth and the eighth that were mentioned, I've also seen health practitioners of various sorts with benefics related to the sixth, as well as work with animals. And then the eighth, the person asking the question mentioned people working with other people's resources. And that can be like accountants or bankers, people who work with other people's money, like because it's a shared resource thing. But I've also seen an additional manifestation of people who work with others around significantly traumatic topics. Like I've seen people work with the topics of sexual assault with the ruler of their 10th house of career in the eighth and things like that. So I think to me, the major difference is helping other people in those circumstances.
Yeah, I would agree, Lisa. I've seen a few of those examples myself. The surgeons, I'm thinking of one client who has a Venus-Mercury really tight conjunction in the 12th, who's a very well-respected surgeon. And then the 8th house with the other people's money, it comes up a lot with accountants. Or I had one student who worked in, she had the ruler of the 10th in the 8th, and she worked in a government agency around taxation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess the point of the benefics there is that you can somehow be helpful around the topics rather than be subjected to the consequences of the topics, mm-hmm. I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I had a client who had the ruler of the 10th and the 8th, and they were a mortician. That was one of my favorite examples. Mm-hmm. And then a doctor who had the ruler of the 1st and the 10th and the 6th. Very well placed. I mean, that's the other thing though. So there's a few additional nuances to this, but one of them is that I definitely feel like there's a tendency for those placements to work out in constructive or positive ways where the person is like helping other people or is somehow making good use of what would otherwise be a bad situation. When there's mitigations involved. So an example of a mitigation, for example, is like if a planet's in the sixth house, if it's closely configured within 3 degrees to the degree of the midheaven, that can be a major mitigating factor. That's something that's commonly mentioned in the Hellenistic tradition. And it's one of those techniques that I actually found to work out really well in chart examples, where even if a planet is in a difficult house, if it's configured to the degree of the midheaven, it will still have a tendency to work out in a very constructive way, or for there to be positive manifestations of the placement, even though it can sometimes be in a more challenging context, like, you know, illness or death or loss or what have you. So that's one thing. There's other types of mitigating conditions as well, like if benefics are configured to the placement, or if the planets are aspecting planets that are otherwise themselves angular, like planets that are in the 10th house. And things like that. So
it almost sounds like it comes back to a point that we made on an earlier question where you have to apply all the rules together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's not as simple as saying, oh, such and such is in the 6th or the 8th or the 12th houses, therefore bad.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the issues, because people don't usually learn, you know, you don't learn the entire system, and astrology, modern astrology, is not typically presented in a way that it's that systematic. So you really have to find some form of like traditional astrology that is presented in a more systematic way that treats you all of those conditions. And usually in traditional astrology, one of the things that puts people off is it's always phrased in terms of extremes. So they'll give you, yes, you know, the delineations are usually like the extreme version of like worst case and best case scenarios for this placement. But what they don't tell you is, you know, then there's like 10 or 20 mitigating conditions that will move this more towards the middle or more towards the opposite end of the spectrum. When there's things like, you know, they'll say planet in the sixth house indicates like illness and injury and blah, blah, blah. But then later you'll read, however, if it's configured within 3 degrees of the midheaven, then it'll work out favorably. And then you find a chart of somebody like that, that's a doctor or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So, really. And I don't really know how to get around that, except because
I think it's where classes come in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's where having a teacher that says, because a live person can explain some of the nuances on the fly, which you may not get if you're just reading bits and pieces of a text or picking up pieces of a whole rather than the whole complete system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is where I'm going to go ahead and pitch my course, which...
that was kind of me to set this up for you, Chris.
Right.
Well, you didn't even pay me today.
And your course, and then also Lisa's lecture, because I know all three of us in different ways, you know, do that and talk about the placements and show you the system, but then also show you the mitigating conditions. So, you know, in my course on Hellenistic astrology, it's in 10 parts, and I go through all of that in terms of introducing all the basic concepts and like, you know, what's a good house versus what's a bad house, but then going into the conditions of things like bonification and maltreatment, which can show either extreme instances of positive and negative, or it can show, you know, what are the mitigating conditions that can throw off, you know, a bad placement and make it much more positive or constructive than it should be otherwise? Or what are the, you know, negative conditions that can throw off what should be a good placement and make it manifest in a way that's the opposite? So you can find out more information about that at chrisbrennanastrologer.com/courses. And then, of course, I know, Kelly, that you do a lot of courses on natal astrology like that as well, that get into things like that, right?
Yeah, I teach an 18-month practical astrology program, which is designed as a foundation course to bring students from basic beginners, I don't know how to read a chart, to learning a few handy forecasting techniques and relationship compatibility. And it, of course, it does have I wouldn't call it Hellenistic in any scope, but it definitely has a traditional flavor. Yeah, and I teach those online all the time.
And then, Lisa, you also have in your lecture on Saturn returns, that was one of the things that you do really well in that lecture, is that you show how sect is this important consideration to take into account when you're looking at somebody's Saturn return and just their natal Saturn placement in general, and how they're likely to experience that. But then, and you show some of the worst case scenarios, but then you go into different mitigating conditions that show when it's still going to be much more positive than it would be otherwise, even though it's otherwise a difficult placement, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that lecture is specifically focused on the Saturn return, but it does go through a bunch of those different conditions that you could also apply more generally, just in terms of different mitigating factors.
Sure. So I think that's really important. And one last thing with this question that I thought was interesting is that she mentioned, because this relates back to the house division issue, where she says, I do understand that you work with whole sign houses. So you would move Mercury to my first house. Although do bear with me, as I've seen the 12th house Mercury affect all of my relationships. And this is actually a really
a perfect example,
yeah, right, of what we were talking about earlier, because, you know, when we all pull up her chart, it's like she's been reading delineations of Mercury in the 12th house. And that's why she thinks that, and Mercury is the ruler of her 7th house. So that's why she thinks that she's had, you know, whatever unspecified problems in relationships she's had in the past. But when we, you know, pull up this chart, one of the first things that we see is that Mercury is closely square to Mars and Saturn, right?
Mm-hmm.
100%.
So that actually...
It doesn't matter what house Mercury's in. got some tricks.
And I don't know that I'd go that far. I would just say that, you know, there's oftentimes other reasons why a planet is, you know, acting in a certain way. And sometimes it's easy for people to get used to assuming that it's because of one thing. And then if they look at it in another system and that's taken away, they're like, well, that doesn't make sense because Mercury's then not my 12th house. And therefore, there's no reason for it to, you know, for me to have had such and such experience surrounding it. But then you realize there's other factors sometimes that can reiterate or can show you the same thing or similar things that you may not realize or may not be paying attention to.
Yeah, exactly. And in addition to the Mercury square Mars Saturn, I noticed that Venus, as a general significator for relationships, was in the 12th house in the whole sign system. So it's like an additional factor sort of pointing to 12th house things, even though Mercury, as the ruler of the seventh, has now moved to the first.
And this, like, it really speaks to that point, I think, of if you want to use a more modern system, then use a more modern house approach. And if you're interested in learning the Hellenistic ideals or some of the traditional approaches, it may be better to then switch into one of the older house systems. That idea of using not parts of multiple systems, but maybe trying to get something cohesive because, yeah, that way you'll see all the right pieces in the right way.
Yeah, definitely.
Sure. Although I know, because I can already hear objections where some, you know, traditional astrologers would object, saying, you know, but the Lily people use Regio and Hellenistic are using whole sign. So what tradition?
Well, totally. But there's different philosophies there, I guess, like some of the ideas that Lily really employs, perhaps, versus the whole sign. I mean, I don't know. You would probably be able to speak to that better.
Sure. Anyway, there's other positive things going on there in terms of the seventh house. So not to get, you know, too down on that example, but I know it was just something that jumped out to me that I meant to mention just because that comment, it sort of tied in with some of the things we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I think we've run out of time. So I think we're out of time, right, Kelly?
I do have to dash off. I mean, you guys can carry on if you want.
I think we've talked enough.
You might have exhausted your talking podcasting allocation for today.
Yeah, 2 hours and 17 minutes, I think, is a pretty good run for one day.
Cool.
All right. Well, this has been great. I forgot to say at the end of the Tarnas question that I'm in the process of setting up an interview with Richard Tarnas at the end of July. So hopefully 1 month from now, that'll go through and I'll be interviewing him just to connect to the previous question. So perhaps I'll be able to ask him, you know, about some of that or discuss that with him directly during the next show. All right. So this has been great. I think this went really well. So thank you both for joining me. You guys were awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Anytime. Thank you.
All right. And people can find out more information once again on your websites, which is kellysastrology.com and lisascheim.com. Do you guys have any, or is there any like parting things before we go or anything that you guys meant to mention that you didn't get a chance to?
I think I covered everything on the questions we brought up.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, awesome. Well, we'll have to do this again sometime. Thank you to everybody that sent in your questions. Sorry to those that we didn't get a chance to get to. If we do another one of these shows at some point, then maybe we'll try to take some of those previous questions and bring them forward to the next episode. Otherwise, if anybody has new questions or other questions, please send them in and I'll start filing them away for if we do another one of these Q&A sessions. And I guess we'll see you next time. So thanks, Lisa and Kelly, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time.